Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we're talking about all things recessions, the various ways to identify future recessions, how we can make them less severe, and even if they can be avoided altogether. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Claudia Somm. Claudia is the founder of Stay at Home Macro Consulting. She is a regular opinion writer at Bloomberg and the New York Times, and she's the author of The Somm Rule, a reliable early indicator of coming recessions. Previously, Claudia was a section chief in the Division of Consumer and Community Affairs at the Federal Reserve Board, where she oversaw the survey of household economics and decision-making. Prior to that, she worked for 10 years in the Fed's Division of Research and Statistics, and she was also a senior economist in President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Claudia, welcome to the show.
Excited to be here.
So Claudia, we're very glad to have you on today. You've put out some really stellar research in recent years, and I'm eager for our listeners to get the opportunity to hear from you. Today we're largely going to discuss your work on how we can better predict recessions and some of the things the federal government can do to make them less severe or perhaps prevent them altogether. So I think the best place to start would be to have you outline for our listeners some of the current recession indicators that are used by economists and policymakers and how your indicator, the Somm Rule, differs from them.
Right. So we know that recessions come. They're not all the time. They're somewhat rare events, but we haven't figured out how to stop them from coming, as was apparent this year with the pandemic. And they're hard to predict. And what is maybe not intuitive is it's actually hard often, not this time, but often it's hard to know if we're in a recession. Because usually people lose their jobs, businesses close, but it's slow, right? In the COVID crisis and recession, we saw everything fall apart within weeks, and it was quite apparent we were in a recession. But a typical recession, and what we've seen in the past, and God willing, we'll see in the future, is one that actually is hard to say it started, let's get the relief going. And so the project that I had worked on was, it was a way to fight recessions of fiscal policy. For it to be effective, it needed to get going as soon as we were in a recession. And so what I developed, and looking at the data, past experiences, is that a small increase in the unemployment rate, and by small, I mean looking at monthly unemployment, three-month average, just to smooth out the bumps and wiggles, if you have in the current month, that measure is a half a percentage point, above where it's been over the prior 12 months, you're in a recession. And that was highly accurate in recessions since the 1970s. Like, it was accurate every time. And even going back as far as we have the data, it's highly accurate. So what's really good about this measure, in addition to being accurate, is we know it really fast. So the unemployment rate is a statistic that is published early in the month about the prior month. A lot of the other indicators that have been used, like two quarters of negative GDP growth, that takes months and months to see. And then the data are revised. And the unemployment rate is such a quick way to get a read on the economy. And it's why we really hate recessions. People lose their jobs. And so I think this was really important, especially for the question of, okay, we want to fight recessions quickly. We want to make it automatic, which I'm sure we'll talk about more. But we need a trigger. We need a moment where we say, okay, let's go. And that's what I was working on. And that's what became later known as the Somm Rule.
Right. So you developed this indicator to identify a coming recession, but you also have this automatic stabilizer component as well. Can you talk a little bit about how this would work in practice and why another automatic stabilizer is needed rather than having Congress
vote on a fiscal response every time a recession hits.
Yeah. So the first thing I want to clarify is the SOM rule doesn't predict a recession. It tells us we're in one in early months. There are other ways, you know, the yield curve, special model. There are ways that economists try to predict a recession. That's really tough, right? But because my purpose was a little bit different, because I wanted to have automatically Congress would send out checks to everybody, these direct payments. So we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. So I wanted to make sure that I had a trigger that said, okay, now's the time to go. And it wasn't a false alarm and that kind of stuff. So predicting recessions is really important if we could ever do it right. What I was trying to do was say, we're in one, let's go. And my specific proposal was about sending payments to people, right? And we saw this. Part of the relief package that Congress passed in March had payments to basically every woman, man, and child in the country if they had a Social Security number. And it was big dollars. So it was $1,000 per adult, $500 per child. And in total, it was almost $300 billion that went out into the economy. And pretty much everybody had them by the end of June. And a lot of it went out in May. So it was very early in the recession. And that's important. And that was the research that went into my proposal. While I was at the Federal Reserve, from the very beginning, my first forecast at the Fed was in January of 2008, right? So first year, birth by fire. First forecast, that's when it became clear that the Bush administration was going to get through a direct payment, right? And so from that point on, I studied the research, did my own research with colleagues at the University of Michigan, and I looked at, okay, what was effective? So there were tax rebates in 2008. Obama had a making work pay tax credit in 2009 and 10. That went out with withholdings, like every paycheck was a little bit bigger. And then in 2011 and 12, there was the payroll tax cut. So I was able to study all of these and come to the conclusion that the most effective, particularly in fighting a recession, getting people to, you know, spend a little more than they would otherwise, was a one-time big payment. And so that, and to your point about why is it important that this is automatic? The CARES Act did it, right? And that was where Congress had to get together and pass legislation. So the reason that making it automatic, having Congress commit ahead of time when they're going to start relief and how long they're going to do the relief is really important. And we have seen in the absolute breakdown in talks about more relief, why this is really important, right? Because, and you can tie the relief, I was talking about these direct payments, but you can also tie enhanced unemployment benefits, extra money to state and local government. And what my proposal and the others who've worked on these other components of policies, these are all policies that Congress has done in the past to fight recessions. Let's just let Congress work on the crises of the moment and say, as long as the unemployment rate is elevated, we're just going to keep doing these programs. And so I think this year, as we saw in the Great Recession, but the last months have really underscored why it is so important to put programs like this on autopilot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the less responsibility Congress has with regard to the economy, the better. I mean, more often than not, they're slow and, you know, often, you know, fail to even vote on stimulus packages. And even when they do, they can be insufficient. So let's talk a little bit about how this policy idea would be attacked. You know, in a perfect world, we would distribute the funds to consumers. They would use those funds to consume, but they may use that cash to delever, in essence, to pay off credit cards or save, and it may not have as big of an effect. And I feel like the deficit hawks in Congress and others will use that as a reason not to endorse this proposal. But isn't it a good thing if consumers delever? I mean, if consumers use the funds to pay off credit cards, like I said, it may not have as much of a demand side impact as much as immediate consumption, but having a less levered consumer economy is a good thing, right? I mean, if anything, it just increases the likelihood that they will lever up in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. And I think one aspect of the direct payments that I don't think economists think a lot about, but I do think is very good policy, is you give people money and you say, do with it what you need. Right? Families have had very different circumstances in this crisis. And it is perfectly sensible and good for us all. We've seen that some of the families have taken those direct payments and they've built a little bit of a financial cushion, right? And a financial cushion could be putting money in the bank, so saving it, and it could be paying down those credit cards. So you have a little bit of a margin if you've got to borrow a little bit more. And in a crisis that is so uncertain, like, that's a really good thing. No, it might not boost spending right the moment they get it, but it's helping them. And Congress is telling the American people, we've got your back and we're trusting you to do what you need to do. And it goes out to everyone. So we're not trying to target it. We're not trying to decide who's worthy or unworthy of stimulus. It just goes out. Now, we do see, and this is research that I did with Matthew Shapiro and Joel Semrod at the University of Michigan. These were the co-authors in past studies. And we've seen it with a lot of other studies that have come out, different data sets, different researchers. A lot of people spent the money.
Yeah.
Right. And we had a big question of, well, this recession is really different in some ways, a pandemic. But in a lot of ways, it's similar. Like, yeah. In every recession, people freak out. In every recession, people pull back on spending, sometimes because they have to, they've lost their job, or they're just not sure what's coming. And what we found is that the spending out of these direct payments was really similar to 2008. Right. So people spent it, and that's useful for propping up the economy right now. And we saw it in the consumer spending, like just the aggregate numbers between the direct payments and these extra jobless benefits. There was some recovery. Now, not in the service, like places where you actually had to go face to face with someone. And it was a lot of consumers viewed it as not safe, because it wasn't. Those are parts of consumer spending that we still haven't seen recover. But you could tell, like, the relief worked, the direct payments worked, but they're done, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think even if the funds are used to save, I mean, it's the amount of people that can't make an emergency bill is just way, way too high. So, but what do the data say as far as, how the stimulus payments are typically used by households? For instance, like, what is the breakdown between consumption, saving, and paying off debt?
Right. So the exact numbers vary a little bit across studies. We see that probably somewhere between like a half of the direct payments to maybe up to around two thirds. Like, there's some range there. In total, were spent and spent quick, right? Like, if people are going to spend it, they're doing it quickly, which is very much like past recessions. So they're not setting aside like, oh, COVID's going to go away and I'll spend it later. What we did find, when you go under the hood and ask them, well, what are you going to spend it on? What are you going to do with this? Not surprisingly, there are some shifts in the patterns, right? So in 2008, one of the common responses was to go on a vacation, you know, some kind of, that was a very low response. This time we saw a lot more people saying that they were going to spend money on food, right? So yeah. The patterns you know, when you ask people, what did you do with it? Which economists don't always trust. They're like, just ask people. But when we ask them, like, the patterns made a lot of sense. And, you know, so there were differences between this recession and last recession. But in terms of families needing money and, you know, deciding to spend it or save it or pay down debt, there were a lot of similarities. We did, one difference that we saw is we did have more people telling us they outright saved it. They used it to build a little nest egg. And a survey, as you kind of mentioned, Americans not having a lot of emergency savings. So the Survey of Household Economics and Decision Making, which I managed until I left the Fed, they're the ones that have the infamous or famous $400 question. So what would you do if you faced an emergency $400 expense? So that had gotten to a place, you know, when the survey first started in 2013, half of Americans said they would either borrow, sell something, or just couldn't pay it. Right. Right. Now, it's not to say they didn't have $400, but they said, what would you do? Right. And over time, more and more households told us they had enough cash or they could put it on a credit card and pay it off. So by the end of 2019, there had been a lot of improvement. Now, there were a lot of families still that didn't have a buffer, shockingly many, because $400 isn't that big of an expense. And of course, there are groups like racial and ethnic minorities, young adults, like there were patterns of real hardship, even 10 years into an expansion. So what the survey group did this year is they said, oh, the world is changing really fast. We're going to do some update surveys. So they ran a series of surveys at different points in this crisis. One was before, like in April, like things were falling apart, people were losing jobs, but the relief really hadn't come out. And you saw, not surprisingly, a lot of measures of financial distress, especially among low and moderate income families. Now they did another survey in later in the summer, so after the payments had gone out, and what was shocking, but it makes a lot of sense if you think about it, is that the number of families who said they had the cash, they had the savings nearby that they would, you know, pay that with the $400, it was the highest number it had ever been.
Wow.
So these families had taken the money, the extra jobless benefits that so many people complained, oh, it was more than what they made when they were at work. They took that extra money and they set it aside. And that is so good because there's a lot of, you know, $400 expenses coming out of nowhere right now. So there, but it was a double-edged sword. And then when you saw these numbers, it was yet another confirmation that the relief had worked.
Right.
But by that time, the checks were out the door and this extra $600 a week in jobless benefits, it expired.
Yeah.
And we've seen since then, there's some research that's come out since then that shows that extra savings, it's getting whittled down, right? So we know what, Congress knows what works. Like we know how to support families in a recession and small businesses and communities, but it's gotten mired down in politics, which is not surprising. It's an election year, but we're all paying for that.
Right, right. So let's get back to the size and the frequency. You talk about your idea being a one-time annual lump sum payment. Why not, you know, you briefly touched on the smaller continual payments, but why not smaller payments more frequently so we can sort of see as we go? Is it simply the case that smaller payments don't have as much of an immediate impact on demand?
Yeah, it's that's what we found in surveys that we had done, particularly comparing the 2008 tax rebates, which were lump sum payments, right? So the 2008 payments to the Making Work Pay tax credit. Right. And they were about the same dollar amount. It's just with the tax credit, they were spread out across all your paychecks. Wow. Okay. So we found that the spending response, what households told us is those didn't like mostly increase their save or their spending as much as before. The other thing that we found out, and this is again where I put my little bit of a political economy hat on, people had no idea that they got that relief.
Yeah.
Common mistake on the tax returns that were filed the next year was not claiming the Making Work Pay tax credit. I listened to the survey tapes. We had a little bubble in our survey and we were trying to figure out if we'd confused the survey respondents or the interviewers. Thankfully, it was the interviewers, not. But I listened to the tapes and there was one woman, bless her heart, because we in the question, we remind people about how much it is per week. We don't expect them to have all the details. And she was like, well, you can tell the president where to take that. I mean, like she was so incensed because she's like, I don't need an extra $30 a week. I have like massive problems. So it was like, oh, okay. So I'm firmly against stealth stimulus, right? Like don't tell people you're helping them because there's an aspect of recessions where people are just scared.
Right.
Right. And so they need to know that the federal government is trying to help them. If they don't know you're doing it, it's not going to do anything to reduce those fears. Now, the other thing, and there was an additional reason why not to do that this time, is that we saw millions of people lose their jobs, right? So at the peak of this crisis, we had almost 20% of workers out of work. We had millions of people with pay cuts, which pay cuts for people on the job in a recession have not been seen since the Great Depression, right? So in our survey by June, like 40% of families told us they had lost income in the crisis. And a lot of this, I mean, the bulk of it was coming from some kind of labor income. So, okay, if you deliver relief via paychecks and a bunch of people don't have paychecks, well, that's not going to help. And some of the proposals like the payroll tax credit, you get a bigger chunk of relief the higher your salary is. So if a bunch of people have lost their, you know, their wages are down, like this isn't helping. Right. So I think in this crisis, there were even more reasons. Don't do it through withholdings. Just get money out.
Right. Right. So what about, you know, you hinted at it earlier. What about targeting the money towards lower income families rather than everyone? I mean, I like the idea of everyone getting the same amount. I mean, I've long favored a universal basic income that is the same for all Americans. But, you know, there are some out there that would prefer a policy like this to be means tested because some people don't need the additional assistance. Is it that if we did that, the stimulus wouldn't be enough to get the economy back on a steady growth path, or is it that you know, we want to treat everyone equally, and by doing this, we ensure that the stimulus impacts all sectors of the economy?
So the most important reason is we can't do it. Right. So, and this is a discussion I have with academic economists a lot, because the research largely shows that the biggest bang for the buck is if you get the relief to families that have very little in easily accessible savings. So we call that liquidity constraint. Like they really would have liked to have been spending more before the recession. They didn't have the income. They didn't have the savings built up. So like you give them money and they just go, right? Because they have stuff to spend on. Okay, fine, right? But the federal government does not know what is in your checking account. Right. They don't know how much you have in money mutual funds, right? So, okay, that's a total non-starter. Mm-hmm. Given the information we have right now, the other thing you could do is say, well, let's target low income. Like, let's give bigger checks, or let's only give checks to people with, say, income under $40,000. Okay. So the big problem is that there's a lot more people under $40,000 than there were the last time they filed tax returns. So the Internal Revenue Service does not have, you know, day by day, week by week income going to families. And so particularly in this crisis, when you have 40% of families who are making less money now than they were, you know, the last time the tax returns were valid, you're going to miss a lot of people who are in a bad place. So to me, it's easy. like you just like for Treasury, they got the checks out this time, or the especially the electronic deposits, but also the paper checks in like a month. I mean, yeah. It was amazing. Like they did it so much faster than 2008. It was all set up. And the thing that has really weighed on me is eventually these direct payments were popular with Democrats and Republicans. So I was at a briefing of House Democrats.
It wasn't always the case.
Well, no, actually it wasn't, because on March 11th, so right as things were falling apart, I had the opportunity to brief the House Democrats at their last in-person Minority Whip breakfast. And I and Jason Furman stood up there in our short remarks. And I mean, in general, we were saying go big, go fast, go broad with relief. But we both pointed to direct payments to people, like just get them out. And when we finished, Nancy Pelosi, a hero of all heroes, you're trying to save the world, stood up and she said, you know, I really appreciate all you've said, but I disagree on the payments.
Interesting.
Because they wanted them targeted, right? Yeah. And I get that. And I think the world changed a lot, right? Like we went from this is bad and things are brewing to, oh, wow, like the bottom has fallen out. And it was clear that you had millions and millions of Americans. The way those the first direct payments were set up, like 85% of the U.S. population, like all, like including children, was eligible for a payment. I mean, these were, we've never seen the payments be that broad, right? So they went all in, they went big. We're at the point now where in some of this on again, off again negotiations, it really looked like these direct payments, I mean, they're very politically popular too. Like everybody gets one. So again, right. You don't get into like who deserves and who doesn't. And the thing that was so hard for me is Treasury, U.S. Treasury now has a file of all the names of people who are eligible, all the ways you pay them. If they passed a relief package with those payments, it could be in people's bank accounts within a week.
Wow. Right?
Because they just...
We have that. We have that starting.
Yeah. The thing that takes time is creating that file. So you don't send people three checks and miss one. And, you know, but it's like, it's sitting there. Like, but I mean, they got to approve $300 billion. So like, it's not like it's a, you know, just... I mean, Congress has to approve it, right? That's the only way that money gets out the door.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the infrastructure that we have a little bit later, but let's talk a little bit more about the equity of all of this. You know, when we think about trying to achieve more egalitarian outcomes, how does this policy measure up against something like quantitative easing, something that we've seen to be rather unequal in the sense that, you know, those that own capital benefit far more from QE than those who don't. You know, despite the fact that everyone will get the same amount of stimulus in your plan, isn't your proposal much more progressive than something like QE and some of the other measures that we've taken to stimulate the economy?
It's always the case that Congress is able to get relief out in a recession that is more egalitarian. And even further than that, they can get money out that's targeted, right? So I've been a big proponent of the direct payments, but I was totally save the $600 team in this summer, because the people who are really hard hit are the ones that don't have jobs. Right. So they absolutely have to get money. There are state and local governments that are just hemorrhaging money, laying off nearly a million teachers already. So like there is need that is really acute. So we do need to address that. I think sometimes the direct payments kind of give cover because they're very broad and they give cover to some of the more targeted programs where it gets a little tricky about who should really be getting the extra money? And is it fair that they're getting more money than when they were at the job? And some people have had to be at the job because they're essential workers and then they miss out on that, but they get a payment, you know? So I think there's a lot that Congress can do. Now it's true. If I had to compare the direct payments to quantitative easing, like knock it out of the park in terms of being egalitarian.
Right.
And it's what's, I don't know, perplexing is not the right word. What is unfortunate is that for decades, economists were of the belief that the Federal Reserve was the institution that should handle recessions.
Right.
We went so far as to have Bob Lucas before, and this was in the mid-2000s, at his presidential address for the American Economics Association, essentially said, we got this. We know how to deal with a recession. The right. Federal Reserve, like, just, you know, they're the game in town. Unfortunately, the Fed's tools have always been, they're diffuse in a sense, like, this was always about moving interest rates around. They're diffuse in the sense that they can't target it to the unemployed. They can't target it to a community that's being particularly hard hit. What has become even more of a problem is they operate by moving around either interest rates or asset prices. I mean, that's just kind of the way it's worked. Well, not everyone has assets, right? So the stock market has more than recovered. But, you know, for the unemployed person that didn't have stocks, well, they're not better off because of this, right? And so the Fed, and it's, they're not trying to make inequality bigger, but the tools that the Federal Reserve has, at least the ones they have now, they could get some new ones, but the ones they have now just are not designed in a recession to address, like, the pockets of hardship, or let alone just, like, evenly, you know, help people, especially when you think about Main Street versus Wall Street. Like, they don't have the tools. Congress has the tools. Unfortunately, what we've seen now, and we saw it in the recovery from the Great Recession, is Congress just loses the will.
Right.
They start fighting. I mean, everybody's a Keynesian in the crisis, like, they're in the foxhole, in the crisis. You know, in March, we saw this. They'll come together, put partisan aside, get the money out. But as we get into a place where we see some recovery, it's not free fall, the stock market has recovered, then you get into this, wait and see, oh, it's getting to be a lot of money. And that is so damaging, because the faster we get out of this hole, the better it is for everyone, and in particular, the better it is for people who are getting hit really hard. Like, and we've seen damage going from being what should have been very temporary. Like, we should have got this virus under control. Yeah. And now we're seeing the temporary layoffs turn into permanent layoffs. And we know from past experience and research that permanent layoffs, or coming out into the job market in a severe recession, these aren't effects that are gone in a year or two. And in some cases, they can last a whole career.
Right.
So this is, like, very, very bad. We saw this train wreck in the Great Recession. This was part of why I and other people worked really hard on, let's do automatic stabilizers. So we'll take that potential to make the wrong decision again out of the hands of Congress. But it didn't happen, right? There was a lot of interest. I think I counted up a month or two ago that I have worked with over 30 Hill offices since I left the Federal Reserve. And that was within, like, a week of leaving in November. I started working with a group. And of course, after March, I've been working on a lot of these proposals. There's some really good proposals that are out that are particularly focused on the enhanced jobless benefits and tying when they kick on to the SOM rule and when they turn off, when the unemployment rate gets back within close to where it was. So there's momentum. These cost a lot.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in a severe recession, it could go on a while. But I truly believe it's money worth spent. And if Congress committed to do this, it probably would cost less than we think, because the economy would recover faster and these programs would turn off faster. So I feel like, unfortunately, what's happened, particularly since July, has emphasized how important it is to put programs like this in place.
Right, right. So I want to know, how does consumer sentiment fit into your model? You know, we've seen in recent years how effective forward guidance has been in making the Fed's commitments much cheaper, in essence, by the Fed communicating its strategy publicly, you know, saying it's willing to engage in a certain amount of QE and backstop various asset classes. investor sentiment in those securities increased, and as a result, the Fed has had to intervene in those markets far less often, and to a much smaller degree, because it becomes somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Does the same thing happen under your proposal? You know, you talk about each year. You know, we would check and see, you know, where we stand, and we could have another annual lump sum payment if needed. But it seems to me, if we are communicating this well, that in itself would do wonders for consumer sentiment, and as we know, consumers make up 70% of the economy. So how does that fit into your model?
Yeah, so absolutely. Let me take it in two pieces, though, because first you talk about the Fed, which is I mean, the Fed is different from my proposal, but okay, the Fed is good at communicating with Wall Street, right? So they have moved and do move investor sentiment. I like to joke that after being at the Fed for over a decade, I have the decoder ring, right? Like, I can read a statement, I can watch a press conference, and I watch all of them, and I can hear what they're saying. Like, the words have very precise meaning. Right. Now, the investors on Wall Street, they hire economists. Actually, a lot of my former colleagues are on Wall Street doing these jobs. They have the decoder ring too, right? So they can translate what the Fed is doing. It is true that when the Fed just set up some of these facilities that were dealing with different asset classes, you saw that market. And one of the most frightening ones was the US Treasury market in March was having a lot of disruptions. And you're like, oh, wow, that is really, really bad. The Fed set up some lending facilities and that market calmed down because they knew the Fed was saying, we will be the backstop. If this market isn't functioning, we're going to go in and we're going to get it functioning. And they did. And then it was like, okay, investors calm down, right? And so it's true that for a lot of these lending facilities that were geared towards Wall Street, they had to do a lot less. Now, there's a lot of research. I have a good friend, Katya Pineva, who is still at the Fed and like leads the inflation group. And she's done a lot of research with the same survey, the household survey I've used to do the stimulus work, where they basically are seeing if households are responding, like when the Fed goes out and does forward guidance or they talk about something, and they can see measures that are put together by Wall Street analysts that do move, right? Inflation expectations and things react. Households, nothing, right? Like they don't, I mean, most aren't, I mean, I'm in a rare group that watches every press conference and doesn't work on Wall Street or for the Fed anymore. And frankly, even if they saw their communications, and I was talking to a young man who's very interested in economics, and he's like, I watched the Jackson Hole speech, which is the annual speech, and Powell talked about the framework. And he's like, I didn't understand it. And I was like, well, it wasn't written for you, right? So the Fed has some really serious communication issues. And I, as a totally other passion of mine, is trying to work on bringing the Fed to the people. I mean, that's what I do for the New York Times. I'm writing about the Fed and trying to like explain what they're doing in people words. And maybe they'll learn and they'll do it themselves. With the direct payments, with my proposal, the communication is so clear. Like, you don't need to listen to the news. You don't need to hear Congress pass it. It shows up in your bank account, right? If you all of a sudden, like a couple $1,000 shows up, I mean, regardless of where it came from, you're like, I get it. Money talks, right? So it's a very clear signal. Now, and one of the things I've seen in this administration is really trying to talk up the economy. And we kind of tried to talk away the virus, but you've seen a lot of like, it's going to be okay when we reopen, things are going to get better. And I understand where that's coming from. Like, they're trying to get people like, it's going to be okay. Like, I see the end and I'm going to go out and spend, or I'm going to like keep people, you know, hire people back. Okay, but words only go so far, right? Like, you actually have to deliver. And the one of the reasons I think the payment should go out to everyone is we see in these household surveys that in the reset, like right when it gets going, everybody's sentiment plunges, yeah. Right? Like, and so like everyone's in a bad place. It's true. High income families have more of a buffer and they can come back faster. They also spend a lot of money, yeah. Right? So you want to like do stuff that really convinces people is going to be okay. Now, the part of my proposal that I think is very intuitive, and you were talking about this too, is if it's automatic and you know it'll come every year, or I've worked with members who are thinking about in this crisis something more frequent, like quarterly, which I agree. Like right now, quarterly, I've talked to some that want it monthly. I'm like, you know, knock yourself out. Like how much money you can get out is fabulous. But it gives a sense, it reassures households that as long as unemployment is high, as long as we're really struggling, there will be regular help. Now, it's very intuitive, though we haven't done anything like this, so I couldn't, you know, promise it's going to be the case. But that kind of support should even more so encourage people, calm fears. But it's not doing it in a like words only. I mean, it's doing it with real money and real support. So I think that is an important piece of it. And I just think Congress, because they have the ability to just get money out, yeah. They can communicate that. They can calm fears in a way that the Fed, bless their hearts. I mean, they don't have the tools to get the money out in the same way Congress does. And they don't quite know how to talk to people. Right. So those two things together, it's really like Congress. And what's fascinating is the Fed, in a way more direct way than ever, has been basically like begging Congress to do more.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So they're at the zero lower bound. They're backstopping all these asset classes. And I think, Powell, Chair Powell came out a couple weeks ago and said, you know, there is zero chance of inflation getting out of control. Please do more. Throw the kitchen sink at it, you know. They have to listen. So, you know.
Yeah. And up to this point, Congress has absolutely ignored him. They've ignored the American people who are clearly struggling. So fingers crossed they do something. But I mean, Congress is unlikely. They're unlikely to act.
Yeah. And I think that is because of having to pay real dollars, which leads me to my next question on the facilities, the infrastructure that the Fed has versus Treasury. Why can't the Fed, instead of the Treasury, push money to consumers? You know, Congress has always had issue with stimulus, especially until this year, stimulus that just sends money to people. So if there are signs of disinflation, which we often see during recessions, why not have the Fed just create reserves and credit accounts or have the Fed, you know, create reserves for those who have bank accounts and have the Treasury deal with, you know, sending checks out to people that don't. I guess my question is, why do we have to actually pay for something like this through borrowing in the capital markets? Why can't we just, if there's disinflation or even outright deflation during a downturn, why can't we just credit accounts?
So we absolutely could, but we can only do it. The Federal Reserve can only do this if Congress gives them the authority to.
Right.
Right. So under their current authority, the Federal Reserve lends money, and they lend money to institutions that are temporarily in a bad place, right? So it's back to this liquidity issue. They need more funds easily accessible, and it's gone. The Federal Reserve has not typically, there are a few exceptions, has not typically lent to any institution that looks like they are insolvent and are unlikely to be able to pay back the loan. Now, there were lending facilities in the CARES Act for medium-sized businesses, so this Main Street lending facility, and for state and local governments, so the municipal lending facility. Those two facilities are basically failures, right? Like, they didn't get the money out. The private, like the municipal bond market did recover some, but for those communities that have some of the lowest grade, you know, near junk bonds, which are also ones that are really struggling.
Right.
Yeah. The market for them didn't really come back. Right. And so there are ways that the Federal Reserve could turn those loans into, you can pay it back over a long period of time. We're going to give you below market interest rates. Right now they have short paybacks, above market interest rates, right? So it's not doing, but the Congress allocated money and they set aside a little bit for losses, but they weren't too particular. They said, okay, Federal Reserve, go figure it out, right? And, but it was run in conjunction, or is run in conjunction with the Treasury. And there, things got bogged down in terms of this question of, well, do we give loans to businesses or communities that, like, they might not be able to pay it back?
Right.
So Congress could go back and just say, no, we really meant for you to get the money out. We'll set aside some more money to backstop losses. Congress could be very specific about below market. Maybe you tie it to communities that have been hit hard by COVID. It's just like the Federal Reserve doesn't want to get into picking winners and losers.
Right.
And in some sense, they shouldn't. Like, the Federal Reserve, it's accountable to Congress. Congress created it. Congress, you know, what Congress giveth, it can taketh, right? Like, it's not like the Fed is, you know, free of any accountability. Members of Congress are elected and are accountable to the American people. The Federal Reserve, the governors, Reserve Bank presidents, the people who make decisions about monetary policy are not elected. The Board of Governors in D.C. is appointed. They do report to Congress, but when you give them the authority, or just, you know, Congress punts and is like, figure it out, Fed, yeah, they are going to really try and stay away from that, because the Fed always gets blamed, and like, the Fed is really going to get blamed. And we saw this with some of the facilities, like the Main Street lending facility. They wanted to make the eligibility a little bigger. Totally makes sense. But they got it on both sides, right? They made it smaller, the, you know, thresholds, and some of the Republicans were like, oh, but that's, you know, small businesses and they're, you know, could lose money and be insolvent. And then they made it a little bit bigger and the progressives were like, but there are oil companies that are now eligible. And we don't. So it just turned into this big mess. And so you can understand why the Fed doesn't want to get into that space.
Yeah.
If Congress told them what to do, they would do it. There are some bigger guns that, kind of what you were referring to, Congress could, and this would have to be well designed for it not to go off the rails, but Congress could say, instead of us doing deficit spending, we're going to do balance sheet expansion.
Right.
And we could set up like these FedNow accounts. Like, everybody could just have like essentially a bank account, just like banks do. I mean, banks all have an account at the Fed. You give everybody, solve the unbanked and underbanked problem. And then in a recession, and this is where I think it would really have to be tied in some kind of an automatic stabilizer, because when Congress and the Fed start like interacting, and there's historical experience, like it can go off the rails. You can have hyperinflation and all this stuff. But if you said, we're only going to turn this on when the unemployment rises, and we're going to shut it off when it comes back down, and Congress determines that, there's a way to basically just use the Fed like a piggy bank.
Yeah, I mean,
Its pipes.
Right. I mean, I think in a perfect world, you know, I envision, you know, using the SOM rule and the Fed just pushing money directly to consumers, but that would require everybody to have an account at the Fed. So, you know, That's a long shot, but I feel like this policy, you know, especially for the deficit hawks, they're going to say, well, we can't afford to spend this money. And, you know, which is, you know, total garbage. But I feel like if we said, okay, we're not going to borrow in the capital markets, we're just going to have you know, a helicopter drop, like Bernanke and others have said, where the Fed is just going to push money to the Treasury's account at the Fed, and then the Treasury can spend it as they wish, instead of borrowing in the capital markets. You know, is that a possibility?
There's a lot of different ways to do this. Again, yeah. Congress has to do the authority, and I really do believe that it has to be done carefully, right? So it stays like all of this spending is accountable to the American people. I mean, it's true that, I mean, there's a deficit clock, right, in Congress, right? So people pay attention to that. Not everyone like me looks at the weekly balance sheet statements of the Fed. I mean, always looking like surely another municipal loan got out. So it is true that you could put it there and it's less apparent to the American people, but it's still there. I mean, the federal government is still sending money out and it's not a tested policy. Right. Like it's in even in like the United States, I mean, Japan has been in something of this space where they're taking on debt and they're basically saying, we're just not going to pay it back. So this is a term, monetizing the debt.
Right.
But there aren't a lot of examples. And in the past and in some developing countries, there are examples of where this goes way off the rails. Right. So I think we know enough about how to structure it, but I would be leery of just giving the money to Treasury and having them decide, because they've been a little bit of the problem here this time in terms of who's gotten the relief and who hasn't. Right. So, and the Fed, even if you didn't have accounts, the Fed has a payment system through the banks. So what you'd said before, the Fed could get money out through the banks and the Treasury could clean up in terms of getting checks out where the banks weren't the right thing. And this is true for households and for small businesses. The Federal Reserve would be such a better way to get something like the payroll protection loans out than using the Small Business Administration.
Right.
Like, I mean, you know, so there are things to do, but to set up the Fed and use its pipes, like this is not something you do on the fly in a crisis.
Right.
Like, this would have to be part of a bigger discussion about how are we going to pay for the relief during a recession.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason Bernanke and others came up with that, you know, sort of helicopter drop is because we didn't have an automatic stabilizer like you're talking about to stimulate the economy. Essentially, you know, they were writing those pieces because they were at the zero lower bound and there's nothing else the Fed could do. So Congress, please do something. But Congress wasn't doing anything. So, you know, it was this very much out of the box thinking what else the Fed can do. But, you know, if we, you know, implemented your plan, we wouldn't really run into that situation. So how close are we from, you know, getting Congress to adopt this?
I don't know. I mean, this is, I will say there are two committees that when Chair Powell goes, so any Federal Reserve chair goes twice a year and testifies before House Financial Services and Senate Banking. Okay, so those are the two committees that really like spend the most time thinking about the Fed. Before the crisis, I went and met with a staff member and had these ideas, right? And one of them was helicopter drops, which I don't like that term. And when Bernanke talked, it's very academic and he did not come down in favor of it, right? Because it really is the nuclear option. But he did talk about it because he's a good academic. I looked at it and there were a couple of things like, you know, lending to Puerto Rico. And there were some things that were like, oh yeah, I've seen that. And then there was this one, and it was money, finance, fiscal policy. And this is essentially, you know, Congress's fiscal policy, use the Fed as the piggy bank, right? And I looked at this and I was like, you would blow up the brains at the Fed if they saw this as a proposal that came out. Now, fast forward into this crisis, and particularly in March when like the relief package hadn't come together. I mean, Congress moved really fast, but it was like 1 week it looked pretty like not like it was going to be good. And then the next week it passed and it was amazing. Right. So things move fast. And even from then, and especially as like Congress is walking away or just can't get it together, it's like, you know, this actually isn't absurd. right? Like, I mean, the world we're living in is absurd.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of like, well, you know, maybe we got to think big. Now, the concern I have is I haven't seen the Federal Reserve doing the blue sky thinking, right? And I think these kind of policies are complex enough that it's going to have to come with technical buy-in from the Federal Reserve and not just a staff member writing up some legislative text and talking to some former Fed people. And there are proposals out there. So Julia Coronado, who is a former Federal Reserve economist, works, has her own macro forecasting consulting firm. And Simon Potter, who used to run the desk at the New York Fed, which basically means the desk is in charge of, like, the Fed wants to lower the federal funds rate. Well, like, you got to go on the market and buy and sell stuff to get it there. So the desk is really the ones that implement monetary policy. So, like, Simon Potter understands, like, the pipes of the Fed and how the markets work. And the two of them have a proposal to get, like, money out directly. And they're thinking through, like, the faster, the digital currency. So it's really, like, it's feasible, but it is blue sky thinking. So I hear that outside of the Fed. As much as I use the decoder ring and I'm trying to read the tea leaves, I really don't hear it. Now, they can't really say it because markets would just go nuts if the Fed came out and said, well, we need some more authority to, like, really, yeah, like, do good by the economy. But it's...
But again, all of these ideas, mm-hmm, are because we don't have something like what you're suggesting. Something that is automatic.
Right. I mean, the what we should be doing is Congress should be doing fiscal policy. Congress should have just hit repeat on the CARES Act.
Right.
I mean, frankly, bigger would have been better, but, like, just hit go, expand it. Even at, like, I think it should be tied to the unemployment rate, but even if you'd, like, gotten it past the election, or not the election, like, to, like, February of next year or something, like, just extend it so we can get past, like, and into the, you know, whoever's in Washington next year, then they can figure out what they want to do. But, like, that's what should be happening. Right. Like, you know, Chair Powell says it over and over again. People like me say it over and over again. Policy wonks, the Democrats say it over and over again. But, like, it's not happening.
Yeah.
Right. So I do get frustrated with the Federal Reserve. I'm like, you know, you've been saying it for, you know, months here and they're not listening. You better go back home and figure something out. Like, because you just can't, like, expect what should happen to happen, because it's not. So we got to have a backup plan. You know, unfortunately, the backup plans are ones that aren't tested, have a lot of potential downsides, could be very disruptive. And so it's like, why are we doing this? Why don't we just do the thing we know works? But we also know this was going to happen. Right. Like, this is exactly what happened in 2008, which was also an election year. The only real relief that got out were the direct payments, these tax rebates that went out in the summer, in, like, May and June of that year. And that was it. Right. Yeah. Because, you know, the administration was changing. We're not going to do anything to help the next administration. It's like this is 2008 all over again. So it was really clear, like, as soon as relief didn't get passed in July, like, the Heroes Act in May, there was no, it's like, we're done for this year.
Yeah.
Right. And it's been frustrating because, you know, it's like, oh, they're negotiating. Oh, Pelosi, take the deal. Oh, and I'm like, has Leader McConnell said anything here? Like, I mean,
yeah.
Like, you know, it's, and it was just, it was so clear, like, nothing was coming before the election. And frankly, if the election turns out what it's looking like, we're not going to get it before the end of the year either.
Yeah.
So, you know, unless we go into free fall again, right? Which is not the price we should have to pay to get relief out of Congress.
Right. But even then, I doubt Trump would sign it after, you know, if he loses the election. But anyway, I want to get to the big question here. You know, it's pretty clear that the SOM rule and the direct payments would make recessions far shorter and less severe. But the big question is, can it be used to prevent recessions? Now, you said, you know, the SOM rule is to, you know, tell us, hey, we're in a recession. But, you know, theoretically, couldn't we use, you know, your methods to, you know, see that? Because I feel like perhaps the SOM rule would tell us that we're in a recession before it's been officially declared. And we could, you know, use the, you know, that rule to see a recession's coming, transfer money to consumers before the real recession hits, and avoid a downturn altogether. Is that possible?
Well, so you could use something not like the SOM rule. The rule of thumb at the Fed, the Federal Reserve, I mean, the small changes in the unemployment rate are just bad news, right? Like, right. I knew that. It turns out, like, the rest of the world didn't really know that. Like, the SOM rule, like, was a thing, right? But to my Fed colleagues, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, they were so not impressed. But the rule that the Federal Reserve use, and it's a little different, but they're, once they see a 3/10 increase in the unemployment rate, they start getting worried, and like the Fed would maybe start doing accommodative policy, like trying to, you know, get things going. Now, the Fed needs to get ahead of recessions because their understanding is monetary policy, it takes some time for it to work.
Sure. Right?
Especially to work all the way through to consumers. So for them, they need signals that are ahead of the recession. That's what I mean. They focus on the yield curve, you know, looking right at how it moves. But the yield curve, I mean, first of all, I think it's most ridiculous. It doesn't have that great of a track record because, yeah, it moves. And a lot of times in like a year or two, we see a recession. You know, like, it's not, but they look for any, like the Federal Reserve will look at any kind of data. They can look at the yield curve. They have regime switching factor models, which I would never write into legislation for Congress, right? And they look at smaller increases in unemployment rate. Because with monetary policy, if you cut interest rates by a quarter point, this is not like sending out $300 billion, right? So right, you can do things. I think in terms of like, how do we, I wouldn't say, like, I don't think we can really prevent recessions. What our goal should be is to make recessions less severe, right? So we should try to not make them as deep and shorten their length. And I think these policies, like the direct payments, like, you know, getting money to state and local, like if you get it out the door really fast, you have the best chance, and you keep doing it, you have the best chance of making the recession not as bad in the depths of it and making the recovery shorter.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, what's going to be most important for most families, right, like middle class on down, is a strong labor market.
Right.
The ability to have financial security, right? And what, I mean, this is one of many tragedies with COVID, is in 2019, we had a year of the unemployment rate under 4%, right? We had people coming back into the labor market that essentially had been written off, right? And so, I mean, there were just all kinds of things happening, and that, like most households build wealth through their labor income. You know, it means a lot to have people employed who want to be employed, have good options. I mean, we still hadn't really seen wage growth, but like at some point, you know, and we saw people like, you know, employers being willing to hire ex-felons, willing to hire people who needed accommodations, like had disabilities. And I mean, so really like things were so good.
Yeah.
And then it just all fell apart. So the thing is we want to get back to February as fast as we can. And frankly, in February, there were a lot of people who were still struggling. So we need to get back to something better than February. And there's a lot of different ways you can do that. Some people do argue for a basic income. Right. So, and this is essentially, you just keep repeating these payments. You start targeting them more. I think, you know, any proposal I would be comfortable with, like those really aren't going to everyone. But if you're not in a recession, I mean, who's low income more or less stays low income? But there are a lot of ways that we can get a labor market that's healthy and strong, that we can have jobs that are like living wages, career paths that exist. And I think all of that is not that you're going to prevent a recession, but you're going to prepare families and businesses to weather the storm. And then on top of that, you have policies in place that get going really fast to make the recession not as bad and the recovery much faster.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you can get those in Congress to listen to you, because you have some great ideas, and there are options. And I just fear that, you know, if we don't do this now, you know, it's going to cost so much more than doing it. So, but you know, Claudia, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned so much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to join us.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I really, this is an important topic, and I appreciate you elevating this, and you know, we're going to keep fighting. So
good. Well, if you want to get more Claudia Somm, go to her blog, macromomblog.com, and visit her Twitter @Claudia_Somm. That's it for us here at The Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion of Are Recessions Inevitable with our very special guest, Claudia Somm. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit demandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.